Good evening, everybody, or good afternoon, good morning, whatever you might be doing. As you listen to us, this is another installment of It's About Time, a DC Sports podcast. I thank you guys for joining us. I am recording Tuesday, February 26th in the evening. My name is Nate, and I will be your host for this evening, again, afternoon, morning, whatever fits your situation. Just a few things to talk about tonight. We're going to continue with the Nats roster breakdown. We're going to be breaking down their outfield today. A new look outfield without number 34 playing in right field. You've got one of the top prospects in baseball, Victor Robles, in center field, most likely to be your opening day starter. And you've got a couple of familiar names that might be rounding out the fourth and fifth outfielder spots. I think the Nats are probably done adding to that position. I think they're probably done adding to their roster as we're heading towards March and getting ready to get closer to opening day on March 28th. So we'll talk about that. I'm going to finish the show talking about the idea that DC is a bad sports town. I've seen some stuff on the internet lately about, you know, pertaining to Bryce Harper, pertaining to DC sports fans in general, and I don't know, something along the lines of we don't deserve a Bryce Harper, or, you know, we're a terrible sports town, that kind of stuff. I'm going to dive into that. I take that personally. I was born and raised in Northern Virginia, you know, 15 minutes outside of DC, and I take that personally. I grew up without baseball in town. Baseball is back, but we were a three-sport town for a long time. We are now a four-sport town, and it bothers me that people attack us so readily. I think they lump us in with what goes on in politics, and it is a transient town. There's a lot of people coming and going, so that certainly makes it more difficult to have a fervent fan base, but I'm going to get into that at the end of the show. I'm going to start, actually, with some big news that happened last week. Zion Williamson got hurt playing against North Carolina. They're calling it a knee sprain, but who knows how long he's going to be out. He's missed two games now, and I'm going to talk about what this means for basketball, but also what it means for college sports, and if it's fair that in football and in basketball they're required to play or sit out, but they're required to play a certain number of years. And in the NCAA for basketball, it's 1 year. For football, it's 3 years before they can go pro. And that's not an NCAA rule. That's on the pro side. That's part of the collective bargaining agreement. Veterans like that rule because it gives them, you know, rookie players or younger players are going to be cheaper than expensive veterans. That kind of builds in job security for veterans. But I've got some thoughts about that, especially what Zion should do the rest of the season, what Trevor Lawrence should do for the next 2 years, what Tua should do for the next year. A lot of interesting stuff I'd like to talk about, and I'm going to start with that. But before we jump in, I'm going to remind everybody that we are affiliated with the DMVSportsNetwork.com. That is DMVSportsNetwork.com. They're an up-and-coming DC sports website covering all things DC sports. Great written content, and they've got some good podcasts that you can listen to, ours being one of them. They have really anything that would suit your fancy: baseball, basketball, football, MMA. Give them a follow on Twitter at DMV_SN. Check out their website, DMVSportsNetwork.com. You know, we're glad to be affiliated with them. Also, follow us on Twitter. It's About Time DC1. That's ITS About Time DC1. We'd love to hear from you guys. Let us know what you think of the show. Give us subscribe to our podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, and rate us, make a comment. That always gives us more visibility, and we always appreciate that. We appreciate you guys listening to us. So the first question, and it's funny, I just typed into my computer just Zion Williamson because I wanted to pull up some information. He's 18 years old. He'll be 19 in July. The very first question that pops up in Google: should Zion Williamson stop playing in the NCAA? That's basically where I was going to go with it, you know, not just with him. I'm talking about Trevor Lawrence. I'm talking about Tua. If Zion stopped playing today, he would still be the number one overall pick in June. There's no doubting that. So what benefit does he get playing the rest of the season? He's not being paid. He's not going to graduate from Duke. All he's doing is putting his body at risk. That's all he's doing. He's 18 years old. Why play another minute this year? I don't see the reason for it. You talk about Trevor Lawrence. He has two more years because he was a true freshman with Clemson. Two more years he's got to play, or two more years that he's got to sit out with Clemson. If I'm Trevor Lawrence, and this one's a little bit more complicated because it's 2 years, plus it's a quarterback position. But if Trevor Lawrence was in the draft in April coming up, he'd be a top five pick. He probably would be the number one overall pick. Based on what we saw in the national title game, he would probably be the number one overall pick. I don't care about age. I don't care about any of that. He is probably the best raw prospect to come out in the NFL draft, or will be in 2 years, certainly since Andrew Luck, and maybe even before that. What does he gain from playing the next 2 years at Clemson? He doesn't gain anything. It doesn't help him financially. His value is as high now as it's going to be, most likely the number one overall pick if he was available in April's draft. So all he's doing is risking injury that could cost him over $100 million in the future. Now, Zion has an insurance policy that pays out if he has a catastrophic injury. This does not qualify for that. And those, by the way, insurance policies are not cheap. Max Scherzer talked about getting one the year, his walk year in Detroit. He was offered something like $175 million to pitch for Detroit, a seven-year extension. He turned it down, and he got an expensive policy. Like, it's not cheap in case he suffered a catastrophic injury. Kirk Cousins got a contract like that when he was franchised by the Redskins. Zion Williamson has one, but that doesn't begin to cover the losses that he would incur if he had a catastrophic injury that could cost him years, could cost him effectiveness. Same goes for Trevor Lawrence. I'm sure Trevor Lawrence has an insurance policy. Tua probably does too. You know, Tua would be a top probably 10, 15 pick, I think. He'd certainly be a first-round pick if he was in the draft this year. He's got to wait another year. These are CBA rules. They're rules set forth by the NFL, by the NBA. Major League Baseball does not have these rules. I don't see how they're legal. Sports are already a monopoly. The NFL is a monopoly. The NBA is a monopoly. And they basically use college ranks as inexpensive minor league systems. And the NCAA makes money hand over fist, and these players don't make a dime. Matter of fact, if they try to make any money off of their own name, they could be suspended. They could face fines. If I'm, especially with Zion Williamson, because he is so close to the finish line, if I'm advising him, I'm telling him, you tell Coach K, I'm done. I'm sitting out the rest of the year. I am not risking. I've shown all I need to show. I'm not risking my financial future to try to win you another college title. Trevor Lawrence is a different story. What would I do if I was advising him? If you sit out two full years, that would damage your value. I think that Le'Veon Bell damaged his value this year just by sitting out a year. I think that he probably cost himself money. I don't think that he thought that he was costing himself money, but if he thinks he's going to get a high guarantee, I don't think he is. If I'm Trevor Lawrence, I'd probably play one more year, but if I suffer any injury next year, then I'm done. I'm going to probably lock it up, and I'm going to go, hey, I'll see you guys at the combine in a year and a half, and I'm going to keep myself in shape. Maybe you leave college and you go play for one of the other leagues out there, the Arena Football League, or what's this, the new AAF that they came out with. They're bringing the XFL back. There'll be options for the NFL for football players. I don't understand how it's legal. But if I'm advising one of these guys, hey, take care of yourself first. I know that they're going to attack you for not being a team player. Take care of yourself first. That's the way I would look at it. Now, another thing that comes up when they're talking about college players, the argument against paying them is they basically say it would tarnish the game, it would ruin the game. To me, that's a completely bogus argument. It's an absolutely bogus argument. These players, especially the ones at top schools, the Zion Williamsons, you know, the Trevor Lawrences, their programs are making a fortune. I mean, you look at what Coach K gets paid, Dabo Sweeney, what he's getting paid. They're making a fortune. Look at what Nick Saban's being paid. I mean, it's ridiculous. The amount of money that the NCAA makes off of these people, and to say that giving them a college education is a fair trade, it's not. It's a joke. For these top flight athletes, they're never going to use their college education. They're not going to have to. Zion Williamson's first contract, whatever it is, should set him up financially for life. Same with Trevor Lawrence. So to say that giving them a $150,000 college education is fair trade for 1 year of Zion Williamson, where the who knows how much Duke is going to make, who knows how much the NCAA is going to make in the tournament if he ends up playing. Trevor Lawrence, 3 years at Clemson. 3 years, they get three. They've already won one national title. It's a joke to use that, to say that it would tarnish the game. That's a joke. It's an absolute joke. Now, if you want to say that it would be tough to structure it, because how do you, you know, do you pay everybody the same? Then it's just as unfair because you have elite players and then you have just role players and backups. That would be getting into the weeds a little bit. I mean, can you essentially give them contracts? And so you say each school has X amount of money to divvy up and they divvy it up among the players however they see fit, something along those lines. All I'm saying is to say that paying NCAA players ruins the game is a bunch of garbage. The system right now as it is heavily skewed towards these universities, towards the NCAA. I think at some point in the next few years, you're going to see the NCAA athletes unionize. I know that they've tried to in the past. I think you're going to see them attempt to unionize. They're going to want benefits. They're going to want most likely pensions, especially football players who are risking their bodies. They're damaging their brains playing in college football games. They're going to want medical, all that stuff. And they're going to unionize because the NCAA is a very lucrative business and they can afford to take care of these guys at least a little bit, especially. And I'm not talking again about the Trevor Lawrences who are going to make enough money to take care of themselves. I'm talking about the role players, because without them, there's no game anyway. We should be taking care of them as well. I say we, I mean the NCAA. I just want to talk about that before I jumped into the Nats, because when I saw that he got hurt, his shoe blows up and it didn't look good. And then you think about the worst possible scenario. Did he blow out an ACL? Is he going to require surgery? How much time is he going to miss? Is he going to damage his draft value? You know, one of the best prospects to come out in a very long time. And that, it just made me feel for this guy, because how he must have felt sitting on the court knowing what his future, I mean, it's such a unique situation. You know, you think about Willis McGahee in the national title game, blowing his knee out, dropping his draft stock, costing himself tons of money. These poor guys, I mean, he's 18 years old. He shouldn't have to feel that. And honestly, if he's good enough at 18 coming out of high school, I don't care what the veterans say, he should be allowed to play in the NBA. Same goes for Trevor Lawrence. You know, you can make an argument that you're protecting these players that are too young to be playing. That's a bunch of bull, all right? Trevor Lawrence is good enough to play in the NFL. He'd probably be a top 15 quarterback next year. Let him play, man. And again, if I'm his parents, he's got to play one more year. I'd sit out my junior year, take care of myself, and get myself ready for the combine and the draft. I don't think anybody, especially if he wins another national title at Clemson, let's say he wins the Heisman next year, his numbers get better. What else is there to prove at Clemson? What else do NFL scouts need to see that they haven't already seen? Take care of yourself. Don't worry about your team. Okay, I mean, that's how they attack them. They're not team players. You're showing who they really are. No, they're taking care. It's a business. Take care of yourself. Owners take care of themselves by cutting people they don't want to pay. You should be taking care of yourself too. Because the owners aren't going to take care of you. If you hurt yourself, you still think you're going to get drafted in the first round, even though you might be out a year recovering from knee surgery, they're still going to pay you what you would have made. No, they're not. So for them to expect you to put that faith in them is a bunch of crap. Take care of yourself. That should be the name of this episode. Take care of yourself. All right, let's move into the Nats. The Nats had their first, now they've had the first few spring training games, but their first game was televised Saturday night at 6:30. Max Scherzer towed the rubber. First batter he faces, he gives up a home run. It's always a good start to the season. But we got to see some flashes of stuff that looked nice. I mean, you talk about Adam Eaton working, getting on base, stealing second base, and then Juan Soto, first pitch he sees, single up the middle to drive in a run. That's the kind of fundamental baseball I think you're going to see from the Nats this year. You got that gritty Adam Eaton at the top of the lineup. Juan Soto is going to be put in a lot of situations to drive in runs. Some people are talking about a potentially, you know, the sophomore slump for Juan Soto. I don't know. He's a different guy. He's a different guy, and we're going to talk about him as we get into the Nats outfield, but he's a different guy. He went to Japan in the offseason, played with the Major League Baseball All-Stars, then went down to the Nats Academy in the Dominican and worked out 4 days a week, working on his baseball stuff. I mean, he is just a worker. He's not taking anything for granted. FP said that. That's not my original. FP said that during a broadcast, but I found it interesting enough to bring up. Juan Soto is a different cat, man. He's a different guy. So that was cool. Another story that came out. Patrick Corbin pitched yesterday. And, you know, $140 million arm. He's a veteran. You don't usually have to leave the comfortable confines of West Palm Beach if you have that stature. But he made up his mind. He wanted to make his first start with the team, so he traveled. He drove himself 2.5 hours to pitch against the Braves. He had a good outing. I believe it was 2 innings, only gave up 1 hit, had 2 Ks. But that shows he's also a different kind of guy. You know, they said that one thing I read in a newspaper article was that doesn't stand out, he blends in. And I think that's going to be a common theme with the Nats this year, is you're going to have a bunch of guys that just blend in and they make one cohesive unit, as opposed to having people that stand out. Max Scherzer is always going to stand out. My mind, best pitcher on the planet. And you have other players that are going to stand out for other reasons. Rendon's going to stand out this year because he's in a contract year. Sean Doolittle is going to stand out because he brings up social issues and he's not afraid to do it, which I commend him for. But you're going to have a bunch of team-first guys this year. I'm not taking a shot at anybody, but I'm just saying team-first guys this year. I'm really excited to watch and see what the Nats can do. Brian Dozier made his debut on Monday. Ryan Zimmerman apparently is going to make his debut tomorrow on Wednesday. Doolittle, the back end of the bullpen, Doolittle, Bearclaw, and Rosenthal, they each pitched an inning today. Didn't give up a run. So things are going swimmingly so far for the Nats. Another story that came out is that they're really focused. Davey Martinez, apparently they brought this up during the broadcast as well, watched a lot of tape in the offseason and realized that fundamentals and bad base running cost them a lot of games last year. And his focus in this camp is working hard on doing the fundamentals right. You're talented enough, you'll make the spectacular plays on your own. The fundamentals, bunt coverage, base running, knowing what base to throw it to, hitting the cutoff man, all of that stuff. They're running apparently 15 defensive scenarios in practice. They have to get all 15 right. If they miss one, they have to add another 5. Really hammering home fundamentals. It sounds like something, you know, when you have a team, it's a mixture of veterans and young guys, and you're like, these guys are adults, they're professionals, they should be able to handle their business. But you know what? Sometimes you need a reminder. of what the right thing to do is. And I like the fact that Davey's doing it. And I think that Davey's going to be able to run the camp the way he wants to this year. I think that he came into an established team last year who had won two consecutive division titles, 95-plus games. They had stars everywhere he looked. Bryce Harper, Max Scherzer, Daniel Murphy. And he was probably, he'll probably not admit this, he was probably a little bit overwhelmed, a little intimidated. It sounds like he's making the clubhouse his this year. He's establishing his dominance. Maybe he's able to do that because there's a big presence that's no longer there. That it was tough to establish dominance when you had that elephant in the room. Could be the case. But I look for good things from Davey this year. One of the big complaints last year, especially early in the season, was about the way he handled the bullpen. He got better in the second half of the season. Davey also, much like Juan Soto, is a worker. I think that he probably pored over tape in the offseason. I think he's going to learn from a lot of his mistakes. Do I think he's going to, you know, instantly turn into Tony La Russa? No, but he's been around baseball long enough. He's been around a good mind like Joe Maddon. And the Nats are as talented as anybody in the National League. So there's reason to believe that he's going to have a better year this year, have a better grasp of the pitching staff, and have a better grasp of the team as a whole. And I look forward to watching what he does as well. All right, so let's talk about, well, actually, before we jump into the Nats outfield, I'll remind you guys again, we are affiliated with the DMVSportsNetwork.com, an up-and-coming DC Sports website. They've got great written content. They release a podcast a day covering all things DC sports. They have a new baseball-only podcast called Half Street High Heat, I believe is what it's called. They've had three episodes recorded so far. Give them a follow on Twitter at DMV_SN. Check out their website. Check out the podcast that they put out. We're happy to be affiliated with them. And, you know, they blast our stuff, we blast theirs. So give them a follow, check them out, and follow us on Twitter. It's About Time DC1. That's ITS, About Time DC1. Let us know what you think about the podcast. Subscribe to our podcast, rate us, give us a comment, anything that you can tell us. We're always glad to hear from you guys. We appreciate each and every one of you that listen to us or listen to me ramble on incoherently. This is a lot like therapy for me, except talk about DC sports. And that actually is going to, when I get to my final point tonight about being DC being a bad sports town, it really does sometimes turn into therapy because it's not been easy, especially the last 20 years being a DC sports fan. But let's talk about, as I grab a drink of water here, let's talk about the Nats outfield. You're really talking about five guys, maybe six. But you got three starters, and we're going to start with the teenage phenom. He's no longer a teenager. He's 20 years old. That's Juan Soto. Made his debut last year, and what a debut it was. He finished second in the Rookie of the Year voting behind Ronald Acuna Jr. Soto, in 414 at-bats, had 22 homers, hit 292, and 70 RBIs. The most impressive thing for a 19-year-old, had a 406 on base percentage. His OPS plus was 142. The guy had a three war season, and that was all offense because defense is still a work in progress for him. He played in 116 games. He just burst onto the scene. I mean, the guy really, I said this to my wife the other night, he was in one season what I think we all expected Bryce Harper to be. Positive charisma, power, doing everything right on the baseball field, and just seeming like he's always having fun. He seems like he genuinely loves being on the baseball field. And he's just a joy to watch. Even the Soto shuffle that he does, I love it, man. I love everything that he does. And I can't wait to watch him in his second season. He was ranked... I think he was ranked, 36th in the MLB Top 100 on MLB Network. That's a lot of respect they're giving him, man. I mean, people believe the advanced metrics on this guy. Again, his defense was down a little bit. Not down. It wasn't that good last year. I mean, his defensive run save was -5, so he's below average in left field. But again, he was brought up for his bat. His defense wasn't ready yet. I think he'll improve. I don't think he'll ever be a gold glove left fielder. I could be wrong. But that's not why you put him in left field. You put him in left field to make the routine plays, to get on base. I mean, the guy had 79 walks in 116 games last year, 99 strikeouts. Great plate discipline. And he's entrenched. He's going to play probably 100 and maybe 160 games in left field this year for the Nats, barring injury. He is one of the two young outfielders that the Nats are going to be relying on for the next 6 years. That second person is Victor Robles. Robles is about a year and a half older than Juan Soto. He's 21. He'll be 22 in May. And he had limited time with the Nats last year. If you remember, he got injured playing in the minors, diving for a ball in center field. He hyperextended his elbow. So he ended up only playing... he ended up only playing 21 games. He was basically a September call-up for the Nats last year. But in those 21 games, he hit .288, had three homers, three stolen bases. He showed his OPS was .874. He showed flashes of what they thought he could be. If you remember, in 2017, he came up September call-up, did so well base running, making contact, getting on base in 2017 in 13 games that he actually earned a playoff roster spot. He was used. He played in two games. He went. He had one run because he scored. If you remember, game two of the National League Division Series against the Cubs, in the eighth inning, the Nats were down 2-0, and Adam Lind led off a pinch hit single down the left field line. Robles pinch ran for him, and then Harper hit that monster home run. That was Robles' moment in the postseason in 2017. I project big things for him this year. Do I think that he's going to be an all-star? No, but I think that he's not going to have a lot of pressure on him. I think Juan Soto actually takes the pressure off of him, and he's not going to be the focal point of the Nats offense. He'll probably bat down in the order. It would not surprise me if he bats ninth with the pitcher batting eighth, and then you basically can go three leadoff guys in a row with Robles batting ninth, and then you have Eaton and Turner. A lot of speed at that end of the lineup. But there won't be much pressure on him batting ninth. He's not going to be expected to drive in that many runs. I think you'll see some fantastic plays from him. He's a natural center fielder. Some fantastic defensive plays. He's going to dazzle you with his base running. His plate discipline, we'll have to see how that works out. But another guy I'm very excited to watch day in and day out. These two guys, Victor Robles and Juan Soto, are the reason why the Nats were not compelled to go harder after Bryce Harper. Because you have these two guys locked down for the next six seasons. And they're both ridiculously young. Soto's 20. Robles will be 22 in May. The Nats are in good hands with these two guys in left and center field. And then you talk about their right fielder. Adam Eaton, he's 30 years old. Just turned 30 years old. Had kind of an interesting season last year. Now, if you look at his just straight numbers, .301 batting average, .394 on base, that's great, man. For a leadoff guy, fantastic. But he only had 319 at-bats. He came into last season recovering from a torn ACL in his knee after playing only 23 games in 2017. And he, in like the first week of the season, it was like a bat out of hell. He was amazing, came out flying, and then he hurt his ankle sliding into home plate. And it took him a few months to recover from that. And he ended up playing 95 games. It was a process. FP talked about this during the broadcast the other night. It was a process for him to get ready for every game because his body just needed to be treated. This year's different. He had a full off season where he could just get stronger. He didn't have any rehab to do. And he was able to just focus on getting better at baseball. He's coming in healthy this year. I expect big things from Adam Eaton. For those of you that weren't familiar with him when he was with the White Sox, he had a three-year span, 14, 15, and 16, where he averaged, 15 and 16, he went 153 games and then 157. He basically hit 300 in 2014, 287 in 15, 284 in 16, on base percentage around 360 all 3 years. He averaged about 14 home runs a season. He's the prototypical leadoff guy. He's going to steal some bases for you, take some extra bases for you. He's going to work counts. He's just a grinder. He's a grinder. He's a very, very good baseball player. And he's under a team-friendly contract, which is always nice. He is making $8.4 million this year. And then the Nats have two team options in 2020 at $9.5 million and then 2021 at $10.5 million. So he's an inexpensive, relatively inexpensive piece, but an important one. And lead off, and he'll be playing right field for most of the season. He'll probably play the bulk of the games in right field, depending on how he feels. But from all reports, he's feeling great and he's ready to go. So then let's talk about the potential fourth and fifth outfielders if they're going to carry five. I don't think they'll carry five because you have guys that are primarily infielders that can also play the outfield. When you talk about Howie Kendrick, you talk about Matt Adams. But what you do need is a backup center fielder because you don't have one. And that is probably going to be Michael A. Taylor. Michael A. has had a roller coaster of a career with the Nationals. He's still only 27. He'll be 28 in a few weeks. But he's shown such flashes of power and hard contact, and he's really elite defensively in center field. But he strikes out a ton. In 2018, in 134 games, he struck out 116 times. 116 times, by the way, in 353 at-bats. So more than about one in every three at-bats he was striking out. The year before, 2017, had 137 strikeouts and 399 at-bats. His batting average, aside from 2017, has been in the toilet. His career batting average is .239. 2017, he hit .271. And people thought that he had really turned a corner. He had an OPS over 800. And then he had that magical, really, postseason in 2017 where he hit .333 against the Cubs. He went five hits and 15 at-bats, and he had the two monster home runs, the grand slam in Game 4 against the Cubs, and then a solo shot a two-run shot in Game 5. And people said, man, Michael A. has really turned the corner. He had a 1.178 OPS in that postseason series. And then he really had a rough season last year. And he had the opportunity with the injuries. He had the opportunity. He was already a starter, but he had the opportunity to really become a producer for the Nats, and he couldn't do it. So now he is again relegated to probably fourth outfielder status, a fantastic, fantastic defensive center fielder. But last year had 10 defensive runs saved. I really like Michael A., and I really want him to succeed. There was a lot of talk on Nat's Twitter this offseason about trading him and just getting rid of him, cutting bait. I don't think the Nats should do that. He's a good young guy. He keeps his mouth shut, does his job, and most likely with the potential for some injuries and maybe wanting to give Eaton a few days off here and there, he's going to get some opportunities to play. He's probably your first man up in the outfield, unless you're talking about, again, Matt Adams or Howie Kendrick. And then you talk about Andrew Stevenson. Stevenson, 24 years old, will be 25 in June. Second-round pick of the Nats in 2015. Last year, limited time, 75 at-bats. He hit .253 with a .306 on base percentage, had one home run, which was his first career home run. Again, really young guy. He had 57 ABs in 2017, batted .158. So he's been working with hitting coach Kevin Long to increase his launch angle to generate more power. Another guy that's pretty good defensively. I mean, a good young defensive outfielder. He can play all three positions, left field, right field, center field. Same with Michael A. If they carry a fifth outfielder, it'll probably be him. But my guess is with him, Andrew Stevenson, he'll probably start the season in AAA. But we will see him quite a bit. He's going to be one of the first guys up, especially if there's an injury to the outfield. I think Andrew Stevenson, having, you know, not a whole lot of service time, only 24 years old, we haven't seen the best from him yet, and I look forward to seeing him blossom. I'd like to see him get a few ABs this year. He's got an interesting stroke from the left side. And then two other names that were non-roster invitees. You have Chuck Taylor. He's 25 years old. He was originally drafted by the Diamondbacks in the fourth round of the 2012 draft. So far this spring training, he's had five ABs. He's got three hits. He's hitting 600. Not that that really means anything, but he spent last year, looks like, in the Mexican League. He also has played independent ball, double A. He's bounced around a lot, but again, only 25 years old. I like his name. Full name is Chuck D. Taylor. But you're going to see a lot of him in spring training. I think he's a big-time long shot to make the roster. And then you have a veteran in Brandon Snyder, 32 years of age. Last year, he was with Tampa Bay, but only played two games. Spent most of the time in the minors. He's also spent time with Atlanta, Boston, Texas, and Baltimore. His career is a .240 batting average. Again, even if they keep him, he'll probably go to AAA, maybe AA. But at 32 years old, he might be a nice call up in the middle of the year if you need somebody to play some games for you. But again, really nothing that special. But he's one of the guys that has gotten some ABs so far this spring. He is 1-for-6 this spring. Is a .167 batting average. He's got one RBI. Nothing special. So that covers the outfield. Again, you got your big three that are going to start the majority of the games. Juan Soto, Victor Robles, Adam Eaton. So I would expect Soto and Robles to each play probably 155-plus games, you know, as long as they stay healthy. Adam Eaton, they'll probably keep him around 140 to 145 games. Keep him fresh. That's where Michael A. Taylor will come in. And then again, any injuries, Andrew Stevenson's probably the first guy up, first guy off the minor league pile to help out the team. It is a place where they were coming from massive strength last year. You remember Brian Goodwin. Obviously, they had Bryce Harper. But they traded Brian Goodwin. Harper is now gone. But they're still pretty deep with two guys that I think Michael A. could be a starter in a lot of places just because of his defense and power. Andrew Stevenson is probably a fourth outfielder on a lot of teams. He's young, but he's got some talent. So the Nats are pretty well stocked in the outfield, especially your two cornerstones in Victor Robles and Juan Soto. Next week, we'll round out the Nats roster by talking about their relief pitching, the big three in the back end with Bearclaw, Rosenthal, and Doolittle, and then what we think of the young guys and how we think that unit will do. That unit is always kind of a wild card for the Nats. Last year, you go into the season thinking they've got the law firm of Kinsler, Madsen, and Doolittle, and that did not work out last year due to injuries, and Madsen didn't have a great start to the season. Doolittle was unhittable until he hurt his foot. So we'll talk about them next week. We'll also talk about more spring training games and how things are looking. Hopefully we will not have, knock on wood, any injuries to talk about. All right, the final point I wanted to get into tonight before wrapping this thing up is, and I'll tell you how it started. It was really kind of benign, but I was on Twitter and I don't remember who made it, posted something, and I was looking at the comments, which is always the worst thing you can do. And this person said that the Nats fans have no passion. And Josh has said this a lot, too. The Nats fans have no passion. They're just there for business meetings and to schmooze. And my reaction, I should not have commented, but I did. My reaction was I went and looked at it because this guy's like, in Baltimore, they're so passionate. The atmosphere is so much better. And listen, I think the atmosphere at Nats Park is fine. Is it one of the best in baseball? Probably not. I mean, it's not Boston. It's not New York. It's not Chicago or LA. But I think it's fine, especially for a fan base that's still as new as the Nats are. I think a lot of people forget that Washington went 33 years without baseball. Not to use that as a crutch, but I went and looked at attendance. The Orioles, because this guy was an Orioles fan, and he likes, you know, Baltimore fans love to trash DC fans as much as they can. Baltimore's 26th in attendance last year, which is expected. I mean, they had the worst season, one of the worst seasons ever, and they were never in it. They were like 50 games out. And the Nats were 12th in attendance. And the Nats have been among the top 12 to 15 in attendance pretty consistently since 2012. Now, does attendance equal passion? I don't know about that. I think it's a fan base that's still learning how to be baseball fans. But the idea that DC is a bad sports town has always bothered me. I grew up 15 minutes outside the city. I grew up in Annandale, Virginia. We had season tickets to the Redskins. You know, we started going to RFK. The Redskins, pre-Dan Snyder, it was one of the best fan bases in all of sports, not just football. One of the most passionate, one of the most loyal. I think also a lot of people forget that in the 60s and 70s, the Redskins went through, aside from, they did go to the Super Bowl in 1972, but aside from the George Allen years, I mean, you're talking about the 60s, they still had Sonny, but they were terrible. They didn't win a lot of games. There was a long period where they never went to the playoffs. I mean, before Joe Gibbs, it wasn't a whole lot to cheer for if you're a Redskin fan, but the fan base was still passionate, and they showed up, and RFK was one of the toughest tickets in town. This was pre-Dan Snyder. The Caps, the last 15 years, their fan base has really grown. I mean, they're one of the best. They're probably the best, well, one of the best fan bases in all of hockey. And the game day experience at Capital One Arena is unlike anything I've ever been a part of when it comes to hockey or basketball. I mean, it's when you're in an indoor arena, it is electric in there. The Caps have a rabid fan base, probably the most rabid fan base in D.C. Not probably. They are the most rabid fan base in D.C. because the Skins fan base has really shrunk. But the attacks on D.C. sports fans, you know, it's a transient area. They only show up when the team's winning. You know what? It's gotten old for me. It's gotten really old for me. And here, a couple of things I pulled just to prove a point. Let's go back. And these two teams with the Wizards and Skins, I'm going to go back to 2000. Since the year 2000, the Washington Wizards are 653 and 867. That's a 430 winning percentage. 430. Now, they've made the playoffs in 19 seasons. They've made the playoffs 8 times. So almost not even half the time. And in the NBA, more than half the teams make the playoffs. The Wizards have been a god-awful franchise to watch. They really have been. They've had talent, but that talent hasn't worked out the way they hoped. You know, John Wall didn't work out the way you had hoped. Gilbert Arenas was there. He didn't work out the way you had hoped. All that stuff. So how are you supposed to be passionate about a team for 19 seasons they haven't been a contender? Really, the Wizards haven't been a contender, Wizards slash Bullets, since the late 70s. I mean, let's be real. They have not been a legitimate contender in 40-plus years. And then you go to the Redskins. This is since the year 2000. The Redskins are 129 and 174. That's good for a 426 winning percentage. Actually worse than the Wizards. They've made the playoffs 4 times in 19 seasons, and they've won a total of 1 playoff game. The Redskins give you nothing. They give you off-season drama. They embarrass you as a fan. And this year, you really, for the first time, saw cracks in the Redskins fan base. Stadium only being 2/3 full, and the people that were there, half of them were for the opposing team. To say that D.C. is a bad sports town, you'd have to say D.C. has bad sports teams. And when you're talking about the Wizards and the Skins, you're correct. They're two of the worst teams in their respective sports. You talk about the Caps, prior to 2018, They were a team that would get you to the second round of the playoffs, and then you would lose in devastating fashion. The Caps and the Nats are very similar in that respect. They find really horrible ways to lose in the postseason. The Caps broke that last year with the Stanley Cup victory against Las Vegas. But another aspect of this is if you look at Washington sports, you had with the Caps up until 2018, this is pre-Stanley Cup, you had one of the premier players in the sport in Alex Ovechkin. And nothing to show for it. I mean, you had great regular seasons, you had some exciting playoff games, but no titles to show for it. The Wizards had a number one overall pick. They selected John Wall. Got nothing out of it. I mean, I got nothing against Wall, but the Wizards have never been a contender under Wall. They've never been a real contender. Even when they paired up Wall and Beal, never been a real contender. You look at the Nats. Back-to-back first-round picks, number one overall in 2009 and 2010, they get Strasburg and Harper, two of the can't-miss prospects. And the Nats had a renaissance. Well, not a renaissance, because it was their, you can't have a renaissance when you're a team that's only 11 years old, but they had an awakening. They had a birth into this, you know, starting in 2012. They've won four division titles, and they've had traumatic losses. They've lost three game fives in the last 5 years. Or I'm sorry, in the last 6 years. So it's tough. It's tough. And then the Redskins, you know, you want to talk about the Redskins, there's a lot of different things. You know, Gibbs came back. That was like, oh my God, the savior returns. Before Gibbs came back, we went and got Spurrier. And everybody's like, oh my God, they got the greatest offensive mind from college football. Gibbs comes back. That doesn't really pan out. Then you have the Zorn years. Then they bring Shanahan in, who's a established guy. He's a personnel guy. They get rid of Serato. And then the Shanahan thing kind of blows up because he went and got McNabb. He had the issue with, you know, the conditioning test for Albert Haynesworth. Then he drafts RG3. They have an amazing season in 2012. Nobody thought they'd have a season like that. RG3 blows his knee out, and then all hell breaks loose. RG3 says, I'm not a running quarterback anymore. I want to throw from the pocket. Shanahan basically engineers his own exit out of town. Gruden's brought in to resurrect RG3. He falls in love with Kirk Cousins. Cousins turns into a pretty good quarterback, and then the front office botches keeping Cousins aboard. It's tough to be a fan of these teams, man. It really is. So for people to trash DC sports fans, for people to trash them, it bothers me. Because anybody that still calls themselves a DC sports fan deserves credit because it has been a rough 20-plus years. It really has been. The Caps win was nice. It was really great for people that follow the Caps day in and day out. I am not one of those people. I'm more of a baseball football guy. But prior to that, it was a desert in DC, a desert. And it still could be a desert. I mean, there's no hope right now for the Skins. There's no hope there. You know, the Alex Smith injury, I didn't even talk about that when you're talking about, you know, just bad luck, bad juju, whatever you want to call it. The Alex Smith injury, the cap hit that they're going to suffer because of Alex Smith. There's no hope for the Skins. I think there's some hope for the Nats. There's a, you know, a three-year window right now that you're looking at, the 3 years that you have left of Scherzer, Strasburg, and Corbin together. Not to mention you've got the young guys, Robles and Soto, Turner. Hopefully they extend Rendon. They've got a great young core, or young-ish core for the Nats that can help them compete in the National League East for the next several years. Losing Harper kind of hurts, especially if you're somebody who is a big fan of his. I loved watching him play, but I'm also on the, you know, I've been torn all offseason. Is he worth $30-plus million a year? I'm not really sure about that. But, you know, it's going to be tough watching him, especially if he goes to Philadelphia. That would be a DC Sports thing for him to go to a division rival, become a perennial all-star. Well, he already is a perennial all-star, but become the Hall of Fame player that everybody thinks he's going to be. The Wizards, where's the hope? I mean, until they fire Ernie Grunfeld, where's the hope? You know, John Wall's out for at least the next full season with his Achilles tear. There's no hope there either unless they get lucky in the lottery and get one of the, you know, premier top two, three guys that can turn your franchise around. And then there's the Caps. The Caps have hit a little bit of a rough spot this year, but they're still slated, most likely going to make it to the playoffs, and then anything can happen. They still have Ovi. Still have a really good core group. The Caps are probably your best chance at another title. The Nats coming in second, and then the Skins and Wizards are a lost cause. So, again, anybody that calls themselves a DC sports fan, I credit you. I credit you to say that we're a bad sports town. It's easy to say that Boston's a great sports town, the number of titles that they've won in the last 20 years. It's easy to say that. It's not easy to say that if you're, you know, it's not easy to say you're a DC sports fan. So I'm sick of it. You know, Baltimore loves to do that too, you know, to DC. They have an inferiority complex, whatever you want to call it. And they like to attack DC in general because they, you know, they know DC's better. So I'm going to leave it at that. It was a weak way to end it. They know DC's better. DC is better, but it's a weak way to end it. But I couldn't think of anything funnier or stronger. So I'll just leave it at that. But I don't think DC is a bad sports town. I do think that sometimes Nats Park does seem like it's disengaged. But again, 162 game season. And for some people, baseball is boring to watch. And you have to find other ways to entertain yourself. The Nats are one of the more exciting teams to watch. And I still like going, and I watch every game on TV that I don't go to. So, but I know that I'm an outlier when it comes to that. Anyway, going to wrap it up by saying we are affiliated with the DMVSportsNetwork.com. Give them a follow on Twitter at DMV_SN. Follow us on Twitter. It's About Time DC1. That's ITS, About Time DC1. Give us a follow. Subscribe to our podcast. Rate us. Let us know what you think. And we'll talk to you guys next week. And have a great week, guys. Take care.